This is Audible.
Audible Studios presents The Spirit Catches You and You Fall Down. Written by Anne Fadiman. Narrated by Pamela Zhang. Preface. Under my desk, I keep a large carton of cassette tapes. Even though they have all been transcribed, I still like to listen to them from time to time. Some of them are quiet and easily understood. They are filled with the voices of American doctors, interrupted only occasionally by the clink of a coffee cup or the beep of a pager. The rest of the tapes, more than half of them, are very noisy. They are filled with the voices of the Lees, a family of Hmong refugees from Laos who came to the United States in 1980. Against a background of babies crying, children playing, door slamming, dishes clattering, a television yammering, and an air conditioner wheezing, I can hear the mother's voice, by turns breathy, nasal, gargly, or hum-like, as it slides up and down the Hmong language's 8 tones. The father's voice, louder and slower and more vehement, and my interpreter's voice mediating in Hmong and English, low and deferential in each language. The hubbub summons a whoosh of sense memories. The coolness of the red metal folding chair reserved for guests that was always set up as soon as I arrived in the apartment. The shadows cast by the amulet that hung from the ceiling and swung in the breeze on its length of grocer's twine. The taste of Hmong food, from the best, Bon Chua, a sweet stalk similar to sugar cane, to the worst, Cha Kie, congealed raw pig's blood. I sat on the Lee's red folding chair for the first time on May 19, 1988. Earlier that spring, I'd come to Merced, California, where they lived, because I'd heard that there were some strange misunderstandings going on at the county hospital between its Hmong patients and its medical staff. One doctor called them collisions, which made it sound as if two different kinds of people had rammed into each other head-on to the accompaniment of squealing brakes and breaking glass. As it turned out, the encounters were messy, but rarely frontal. Both sides were wounded, but neither side seemed to know what had hit it or how to avoid another crash. I've always felt that the action most worth watching is not at the center of things, but where the edges meet. I like shorelines, waterfronts, international borders. There are interesting frictions and incongruities in these places, and often, if you stand at the point of tangency, you can see both sides better than if you were at the middle of either one. This is especially true, I think, when the apposition is cultural. When I first came to Merced, I'd hoped that the culture of American medicine, about which I knew a little, and the culture of the Hmong, about which I knew nothing, would in some way illuminate each other if I could position myself between the two and manage not to get caught in the crossfire. 9 years ago, that was all a theory. After I heard about the Lee's daughter Leah, whose case had occasioned some of the worst strife the Merced County Hospital had ever seen, and after I got to know her family and her doctors, and after I realized how much I liked both sides and how hard it was to lay the blame at anyone's door, though God knows I tried, I stopped parsing the situation in linear terms, which meant that without intending to, I had to start to think a little less like an American and a little more like a Hmong. By chance, during the years I worked on this book, my husband, my father, my daughter, and I all experienced serious illness, and like the Lees, I found myself spending a lot of time in hospitals. I passed many hours in waiting rooms gnawing on the question, what is a good doctor? During the same period, my 2 children were born, and I found myself often asking the second question, which is also germane to the Lees story. What is a good parent? I have now known the people in this book for much of my adult life. I'm sure that if I'd never met Leah's doctors, I would be a different kind of patient. I'm sure that if I'd never met her family, I would be a different kind of mother. When I pull a few cassettes from the carton beneath my desk and listen to the random snatches, I'm plunged into a pungent wash of remembrance, and at the same time, I'm reminded of the lessons I'm still learning from both the cultures I have written about. Now and then, when I play the tapes late at night, I imagine what they would sound like if I could somehow splice them together so the voices of the Hmong and the voices of the American doctors could be heard on a single tape, speaking a common language. AF, New York City, 1997. Chapter 1. Birth. If Lili had been born in the highlands of northwest Laos, where her parents and 12 of her brothers and sisters were born, her mother would have squatted on the floor of the house that her father had built from axe-hewn planks thatched with bamboo and grass. The floor was dirt, but it was clean. Her mother Fo sprinkled it regularly with water to keep the dust down and swept it every morning and evening with the broom she had made of grass and bark. She used a bamboo dustpan, which she had also made herself, to collect the feces of the children who were too young to defecate outside and emptied its contents into the forest. Even if Fo had been a less fastidious housekeeper, her newborn babies wouldn't have gotten dirty since she never let them actually touch the floor. She remains proud to this day that she delivered each of them into her own hands, reaching between her legs to ease out the head and then letting the rest of the body slip out into her bent forearms. No birth attendant was present. Though her throat became dry during her labor, her husband, Nakao, was permitted to bring her a cup of hot water as long as he averted his attention from her body. Because Fo believed that moaning or screaming would thwart the birth, she labored in silence with the exception of an occasional prayer to her ancestors. She was so quiet that although most of her babies were born at night, her older children slept undisturbed on a communal bamboo pallet a few feet away and woke only when they heard the cry of their new brother or sister. After each birth, Nakao cut the umbilical cord with heated scissors and tied it with string. Then, Fo washed the baby with water she had carried from the stream, usually in the early phases of labor, in a wooden and bamboo pack barrel strapped to her back. Fo conceived, carried, and bore all her children with ease. But had there been any problems, she would have had recourse to a variety of remedies that were commonly used by the Hmong, the hill tribe to which her family belonged. If a Hmong couple failed to produce children, they could call in a tzinning, a shaman, who was believed to have the ability to enter a trance, summon a posse of helpful familiars, ride a winged horse over 12 mountains between the earth and sky, cross an ocean inhabited by dragons, and, starting with bribes of food and money, and if necessary working up to a necromantic sword, negotiate for his patient's health with the spirits who lived in the realm of the unseen. A tzineng might be able to cure infertility by asking the couple to sacrifice a dog, a cat, a chicken, or a sheep. After the animal's throat was cut, the tzineng would string a rope bridge from the doorpost to the marriage bed, over which the soul of the couple's future baby, which had been detained by a malevolent spirit called a da, would now freely travel to the earth. One could also take certain precautions to avoid becoming infertile in the first place. For example, no Hmong woman of childbearing age would ever think of setting foot inside a cave, because a particularly unpleasant kind of da sometimes lived there who liked to eat flesh and drink blood and could make his victim sterile by having sexual intercourse with her. Once a Hmong woman became pregnant, she could ensure the health of her child by paying close attention to her food cravings. If she craved ginger and failed to eat it, her child would be born with an extra finger or toe. If she craved chicken flesh and did not eat it, her child would have a blemish near its ear. If she craved eggs and did not eat them, her child would have a lumpy head. When a Hmong woman felt the first pangs of labor, she would hurry home from the rice or opium fields where she had continued to work throughout her pregnancy. It was important to reach her own house, or at least the house of one of her husband's cousins, because if she gave birth anywhere else, a da might injure her. A long or arduous labor could be eased by drinking the water in which a key had been boiled in order to unlock the birth canal, by having her family array bowls of sacred water around the room and chant prayers over them. Or, if the difficulty stemmed from having treated an elder member of the family with insufficient respect, by washing the offended relative's fingertips and apologizing like crazy until the relative finally said, "I forgive you." Soon after the birth, while the mother and baby were still lying together next to the fire pit, the father dug a hole at least 2 feet deep into the dirt floor and buried the placenta. If it was a girl, the placenta was buried under her parents' bed. If it was a boy, his placenta was buried in a place of greater honor, near the base of the house's central wooden pillar, in which a male spirit, a domestic guardian who held up the roof of the house and watched over its residents, made his home. The placenta was always buried with the smooth side, the side that had faced the fetus inside the womb, turned upward, since if it was upside down, the baby might vomit after nursing. If the baby's face erupted in spots, that meant the placenta was being attacked by ants underground, and boiling water was poured into the burial hole as an insecticide. In the Hmong language, the word for placenta means jacket. It is considered one's first and finest garment. When a Hmong dies, his or her soul must travel back from place to place, retracing the path of its life geography until it reaches the burial place of its placental jacket and puts it on. Only after the soul is properly dressed in the clothing in which it was born can it continue its dangerous journey past murderous das and giant poisonous caterpillars, around man-eating rocks in impassable oceans, to the place beyond the sky where it is reunited with its ancestors, and from which it will someday be sent to be reborn as the soul of a new baby. If the soul cannot find its jacket, it is condemned to an eternity of wandering, naked and alone. Because the Lees are among the 150,000 Hmong who have fled Laos since their country fell to communist forces in 1975, they do not know if their house is still standing or if the 5 male and 7 female placentas that Nakao buried under the dirt floor are still there. They believe that half of the placentas have already been put to their final use since 4 of their sons and 2 of their daughters died of various causes before the Lees came to the United States. The Lees believe that someday the souls of the rest of their family will have a long way to travel, since they will have to retrace their steps from Merced, California, where the family has spent 15 of its 17 years in this country, to Portland, Oregon, where they lived before Merced, to Honolulu, Hawaii, where their airplane from Thailand first landed, to 2 Thai refugee camps, and finally back to their home village in Laos. The Lees' 13th child, Mai, was born in a refugee camp in Thailand. Her placenta was buried under their hut. Their 14th child, Leah, was born in the Merced Community Medical Center, a modern public hospital that serves an agricultural county in California's Central Valley, where many Hmong refugees have resettled. Leah's placenta was incinerated. Some Hmong women have asked the doctors at MCMC, as the hospital is commonly called, if they could take their baby's placentas home. Several of the doctors have acquiesced, packing the placentas in plastic bags or takeout containers from the hospital cafeteria. Most have refused, in some cases because they assume that the women plan to eat the placentas and have found that idea disgusting, and in some cases because they have feared the possible spread of hepatitis B, which is carried by at least 15% of the Hmong refugees in the United States. Fo never thought to ask, since she speaks no English and when she delivered Leah, no one present spoke Hmong. In any case, the Lees' apartment had a wooden floor covered with wall-to-wall carpeting, so burying the placenta would have been a difficult proposition. When Leah was born at 7:09 p.m. on July 19, 1982, Fo was lying on her back on a steel table, her body covered in sterile drapes, her genital area painted with a brown betadine solution, with a high wattage lamp trained on her perineum. There were no family members in the room. Gary Thusen, a family practice resident who did the delivery, noted in the chart that in order to speed the labor, he had to artificially rupture Fo's amniotic sac by poking it with the foot-long plastic amni-hook, that no anesthesia was used, that no episiotomy, an incision to enlarge the vaginal opening, was necessary, and that after the birth, Fo received a standard intravenous dose of Pitocin to constrict her uterus. Thusen also noted that Leah was a healthy infant whose weight 8 pounds, 7 ounces, and condition were appropriate for gestational age, an estimate he based on observation alone, since Four had received no prenatal care and was not certain how long she had been pregnant and could not have told Dr. Thewson even if she had known. Four thinks that Leah was her largest baby, although she isn't sure since none of her 13 elder children were weighed at birth. Leah's Apgar scores, an assessment of a newborn infant's heart rate, respiration, muscle tone, color, and reflexes, were good. 1 minute after her birth, she scored 7 on a scale of 10, and 4 minutes later, she scored 9. When she was 6 minutes old, her color was described as pink and her activity as crying. Leah was shown briefly to her mother. She was then placed in a steel and plexiglass warmer where a nurse fastened a plastic identification band around her wrist and recorded her footprints by inking the soles of her feet with a stamp pad and pressing them against a newborn identification form. After that, Leah was removed to the central nursery where she received an injection of vitamin K in one of her thighs to prevent hemorrhagic disease. Was then treated with 2 drops of silver nitrate solution in each eye to prevent gonococcal bacteria, and was bathed in Safeguard soap. Four's own date of birth was recorded on Leah's delivery room record as October 6, 1944. In fact, she had no idea when she was born, and on various other occasions during the next several years, she would inform MCMC personnel through English-speaking relatives, such as the nephew's wife who had helped her check into the hospital for Leah's delivery, that her date of birth was October 6, 1942. Or, more frequently, October 6, 1926. Not a single admitting clerk ever appears to have questioned that later date, although it would imply that Four gave birth to Leah at the age of 55. Four is quite sure, however, that October is correct, since she was told by her parents that she was born during the season in which the opium fields were weeded for the second time and the harvested rice stalks are stacked. She invented the precise day of month, like the year, in order to satisfy the many Americans who have evinced an abhorrence of unfilled blanks on the innumerable forms the Lees have encountered since their admission to the United States in 1980. Most Hmong refugees are familiar with this American trait and have accommodated it in the same way. Nakao Lee has a first cousin who told the immigration officials that all 9 of his children were born on July 15 in 9 consecutive years, and this information was duly recorded in their resident alien documents. When Leah Lee was released from MCMC at the age of 3 days, her mother was asked to sign a piece of paper that read, "I certify that during the discharge procedure I received my baby, examined it, and determined it was mine. I checked the identiband parts sealed on the baby and on me and found that they were identically numbered 5043 and contained correct identifying information. Since Four cannot read and has never learned to recognize Arabic numerals, it is unlikely that she followed these instructions. However, she'd been asked for her signature so often in the United States that she had mastered the capital forms of the 7 different letters contained in her name, Fo Yang. The Yangs and the Lees are among the largest of the Hmong clans. The other major ones are the Chas, the Changs, the Hangs, the Hers, the Kus, the Los, the Moors, the Taos, the Vus, the Zhongs, and the Vangs. In Laos, the clan name came first, but most Hmong refugees in the United States use it as a surname. Children belong to their father's clan. Women traditionally retain their clan name after marriage. Marrying a member of one's own clan is strictly taboo. Fo's signature is no less legible than the signatures of most MCMC's resident physicians in training, which, particularly if they are written toward the end of a 24-hour shift, tend to resemble EEGs. However, it has quite the unique distinction of looking different each time it appears on a hospital document. On this occasion, Fo Yang was written as a single word. 1 A is canted to the left and 1 to the right. The Y looks like an X and the legs of the N undulate gracefully like a child's drawing of a wave. It is a credit to Fo's general equanimity as well as her characteristic desire not to think ill of anyone, that although she found Leah's birth a peculiar experience, she has few criticisms of the way the hospital handled it. Her doubts about MCMC in particular, and American medicine in general, would not begin to gather force until Leah had visited the hospital many times. On this occasion, she thought the doctor was gentle and kind. She was impressed that so many people were there to help her, and although she felt that the nurses who bathed Leah with Safeguard did not get her quite as clean as she had gotten her newborns in the Laotian stream water, her only major complaint concerned the hospital food. She was surprised to be offered ice water after the birth, since many Hmong believe that cold foods during the postpartum period make the blood congeal in the womb instead of cleansing it by flowing freely, and that a woman who does not observe the taboo against them will develop itchy skin or diarrhea in her old age. Fua did accept several cups of what she remembers as hot black water. This was probably either tea or beef broth. Fua is sure it wasn't coffee, which she had seen before and would have recognized. The black water was the only MCMC-provided food that passed her lips during her stay in the maternity ward. Each day, Nakao cooked and brought her the diet that is strictly prescribed for Hmong women during the 30 days following childbirth. Steamed rice and chicken boiled in water with 5 special postpartum herbs, which the Lees had grown for this purpose on the edge of the parking lot behind their apartment building. This diet was familiar to the doctors on the labor and delivery floor at MCMC, whose assessments of it were fairly accurate gauges of their general opinion of the Hmong. One obstetrician, Raquel Arias, recalled, "The Hmong men carried these nice little silver cans to the hospital that always had some kind of chicken soup in them and always smelled great." Another obstetrician, Robert Small, said, "They always brought some horrible stinking concoction that smelled like the chicken had been dead for a week." Fua never shared her meals with anyone, because there's a postpartum taboo against spilling grains of rice accidentally into the chicken pot. If that occurs, the newborn is likely to break out across the nose and cheeks with little white pimples whose name in the Hmong language is the same as the word for rice. Some Hmong parents in Merced have given their children American names. In addition to the many standard ones, these have included Kennedy, Nixon, Pajama, Qatar, Maine, after Merced's Main Street, and until a nurse counseled otherwise, Baby Boy, which one mother, seeing it written on her son's hospital papers, assumed was the name the doctor had already chosen for him. The Lees chose to give their daughter a Hmong name, Leah. Her name was officially conferred in a ceremony called a Hup Li, a soul calling, which in Laos always took place on the 3rd day after birth. Until this ceremony was performed, a baby was not considered to be fully a member of the human race, and if it died during its first 3 days, it was not accorded to the customary funerary rites. This may have been a cultural adaptation to the 50% infant mortality rate, a way of stealing Hmong mothers against the frequent loss of their babies during or shortly after childbirth by encouraging them to postpone their attachment. In the United States, the naming is usually celebrated at a later time, since on its 3rd day, a baby may still be hospitalized, especially if the birth was complicated. It took the Lee family about a month to save enough money from their welfare checks and from gifts of their relatives' welfare checks to finance a soul-calling party for Leah. Although the Hmong believe that the illness can be caused by a variety of sources, including eating the wrong food, drinking contaminated water, being affected by a change in the weather, failing to ejaculate completely during sexual intercourse, neglecting to make offering to one's ancestors, being punished for one's ancestors' transgressions, being cursed, being hit by a whirlwind, having a stone implanted in one's body by an evil spirit master, having one's blood sucked by a da and bumping into a da who lives in a tree or a stream, digging a well in a da's living space, catching sight of a dwarf female da who eats earthworms, having a da sit on one's chest while one is sleeping, doing one's laundry in a lake inhabited by a dragon, pointing one's finger at the full moon, touching a newborn mouse, killing a large snake, urinating on a rock that looks like a tiger, urinating or kicking a benevolent house spirit, or having bird droppings fall on one's head, by far the most common cause of illness, is soul loss. Although the Hmong do not agree on just how many souls people have, estimates range from 1 to 32, the Lees believe there is only one. There is a general consensus that whatever the number, it is the life soul whose presence is necessary for health and happiness. That tends to get lost. A soul can become separated from its body through anger, grief, fear, curiosity, or wanderlust. The life souls of newborn babies are especially prone to disappearance since they are so small, so vulnerable, and so precariously poised between the realm of the unseen, from which they have just traveled, and the realm of the living. Babies' souls may wander away, drawn by bright colors, sweet sounds, or fragrant smells. They may leave if a baby is sad, lonely, or insufficiently loved by its parents. They may be frightened away by a sudden loud noise, or they may be stolen by a da. Some Hmong are careful never to say aloud that a baby is pretty, lest a da be listening. Hmong babies are often dressed in intricately embroidered hats, four made several for Leah, which, when seen from a heavenly perspective, might fool a predatory da into thinking the child was a flower. They spend much of their time swaddled against their mothers' back in cloth carriers called nyeth. Four made several of those, too. They have been embroidered with soul-retaining motifs, such as the pig pen, which symbolizes enclosure. They may wear silver necklaces fastened with soul-shackling locks. When babies or small children go on an outing, their parents may call loudly to their souls before the family returns home to make sure that none remain behind. Hmong families in Merced can sometimes be heard doing this when they leave local parks after a picnic. None of these ploys can work, however, unless the soul-calling ritual has already been properly observed. Leah's hoopli took place in the living room of her family's apartment. There were so many guests, all of them Hmong, and most of the members of the Li and Yang clans, that it was nearly impossible to turn around. Pho and Nakao were proud that so many people had come to celebrate their good fortune in being favored with such a healthy and beautiful daughter. That morning, Nakao had sacrificed a pig in order to invite the soul of one of Leah's ancestors, which was probably hungry and would appreciate an offering of food to be reborn in her body. After the guests arrived, an elder of the Yang clan stood at the apartment's open front door, facing East 12th Street, with two live chickens in a bag on the floor next to him, and chanted a greeting to Leah's soul. The two chickens were then killed, plucked, eviscerated, partially boiled, retrieved from the cooking pot, and examined to see if their skulls were translucent and their tongues curled upward, both signs that Leah's new soul was pleased to take up residence in her body and that her name was a good one. If the signs had been inauspicious, the soul caller would have recommended that another name be chosen. After the reading of the auguries, the chickens were put back in the cooking pot. The guests would later eat them and the pig for dinner. Before the meal, the soul caller brushed Leah's hands with a bundle of short white strings and said, "I'm sweeping away the ways of sickness." Then Leah's parents and all of the elders present in the room each tied a string around one of Leah's wrists in order to bind her soul securely to her body. Pho and Nakao promised to love her. The elders blessed her and prayed that she would have a long life and that she would never become sick. Chapter 2. Fish Soup. In an intermediate French class at Merced College a few years ago, the students were assigned a 5-minute oral report to be delivered in French. The second student to stand up in front of the class was a young Hmong man. His chosen topic was a recipe for le soup de poisson, fish soup. "To prepare fish soup," he said, "you must have a fish. And in order to have a fish, you have to go fishing. In order to go fishing, you need a hook. And in order to choose the right hook, you need to know whether the fish you are fishing for lives in fresh or salt water, how big it is, and what shape its mouth is." Continuing in this vein for 45 minutes, the student filled the blackboard with a complexity branching tree of factors and options, or sort of piscatory flowchart, written in French, with an overlay of Hmong. He also told several anecdotes about his own fishing experiences. He concluded with a description of how to clean various kinds of fish, how to cut them up, and finally, how to cook them in broths flavored with various herbs. When the class period ended, he told the other students that he had hoped he had provided enough information and that he wished them good luck in preparing fish soup in the Hmong manner. The professor of French who told me this story said, "Fish soup. That is the essence of the Hmong." The Hmong have a phrase, "Hai tu zu gao zu," which means to speak all kinds of things. It is often used at the beginning of an oral narrative as a way of reminding the listeners that the world is full of things that may not seem to be connected, but actually are. That no event occurs in isolation. That you can miss a lot by sticking to the point. And that the storyteller is likely to be rather long-winded. I once heard Nakao Lee begin a description of his village in Laos by saying, "It was where I was born, and where my father was born and died and was buried, and where my father's father died and was buried. But my father's father was born in China, and to tell you about that would take all night." If a monk tells a fable, for example, about why animals cannot talk, or why doodlebugs roll balls of dung, he is likely to begin with the beginning of the world. Actually, according to Daning Mong, Myths, Legends, and Folk Tales from the Hmong of Laos, a bilingual collection edited by Charles Johnson, those two fables go back only to the second beginning of the world, the time after the universe turned upside down and the earth was flooded with water, and everyone drowned except a brother and a sister who married each other and had a child who looked like an egg, whom they hacked into small pieces. If I were Hmong, I might feel that what happened when Leah Lee and her family encountered the American medical system could be understood fully only by beginning with the first beginning of the world. But since I am not Hmong, I will go back only a few hundred generations to the time when the Hmong were living in the river plains of north-central China. For as long as it has been recorded, the history of the Hmong have been a marathon series of bloody scrimmages, punctuated by occasional periods of peace, though hardly any of plenty. Over and over again, the Hmong have responded to persecution and to pressures to assimilate by either fighting or migrating, a pattern that has repeated so many times in so many different eras and places that it begins to seem almost a genetic trait, as inevitable in its recurrence as their straight hair or their short, sturdy stature. Most of the conflicts took place in China, to which the prehistoric ancestors of the Hmong were long thought to have migrated from Eurasia, with the stopover of a few millennia in Siberia. Northerly roots might explain the references in Hmong rituals, including some that are still practiced during the New Year celebrations and at funerals, to a Hmong homeland called Du Kai Huo, which, according to a 1924 account by F.M. Savina, a French apostolic missionary who served in Laos and Tonkin, was perpetually covered with snow and ice, where the days and the nights each lasted for 6 months. The trees were scarce and very small. The people were also very small and dressed entirely in furs. However, more recent scholars have cast doubt on these tales of Siberian origins, suggesting that Savina's translations were imperfect or that the songs he had heard may have described the land of the dead rather than a geographic location. Savina's theory may also have derived from his affection of the Hmong and the consequent impulse, irresistible for a man of his time and place, to believe that they were more European than other Asian peoples. A special race midway between the white race and the yellow race, in other words, more like him. Not everyone who knew the Hmong wished to draw them closer. In the 2nd century BC, the Chinese scholar Su Ma Qian described them as a race whose face, eyes, feet, and hands resembled those of other people, but under their armpits they had wings, with which, however, they were unable to fly. As late as the 19th century, many Chinese claimed that the Hmong had small tails. The Chinese called the Hmong Miao or Mio, which means, depending on which linguistic historian you read, barbarians, bumpkins, people who sound like cats, or wild, uncultivated grasses. In any case, it was an insult. Hmong, the name they prefer themselves, is usually said to mean free men, but some scholars say that like Inuit, Dine, and many other tribal names the world over, it simply means the people. The Hmong called the Chinese sons of dogs. The Chinese viewed the Hmongs as fearless, uncouth, and recalcitrant. It was a continuing slap in the face that they never evinced any interest in adopting the civilized customs of Chinese culture, preferring to keep to themselves, marry each other, speak their own language, wear their own tribal dress, play their own musical instruments, and practice their own religion. They never even ate with chopsticks. The Hmong viewed the Chinese as meddlesome and oppressive and rebelled against their sovereignty in hundreds of small and large revolts. Though both sides were equally violent, it was not a symmetrical relationship. The Hmong never had any interest in ruling over the Chinese or anyone else. They merely wanted to be left alone, which, as their later history was also to illustrate, may be the most difficult request any minority can make of a majority culture. The earliest account of the Hmong-Chinese relations concern a probably mythical but emotionally resonant emperor named Huang Ti, who was said to have lived around 2700 BC. Huang Ti decided that the Hmong were too barbaric to be governed by the same laws as everyone else, and that they would henceforth be subject to a special criminal code. Instead of being imprisoned like other offenders, the Hmong, who were not executed outright, would have their noses, ears, or testicles sliced off. The Hmong rebelled. The Chinese cracked down. The Hmong rebelled again. The Chinese cracked down again. And after a few centuries of this, the Hmong gradually retreated from their rice fields in the valleys of the Yangtze and Yellow Rivers, moving to more and more southerly latitudes and higher altitudes. That is how the Miao became mountain people, wrote Father Savina. That is also how they were able to preserve their independence in the midst of other peoples, maintaining intact, along with their language and their customs, the ethnic spirit of their race. Around AD 400, the Hmong succeeded in establishing an independent kingdom in the Honan, Hubei, and Hunan provinces. Since even among themselves they were, as Father Jean Moton, a modern French missionary in Thailand, had put it, allergic to all kinds of authority. The power of their kings was limited by a complex system of village and district assemblies. Though the crown was hereditary, each new king was chosen from among the former king's sons by an electorate of all the arms-bearing men in the kingdom. Since the Hmong practiced polygamy and the kings had an especially large number of wives, the pool of candidates was usually ample enough to afford an almost democratically wide choice. The Hmong kingdom lasted for 500 years before the Chinese managed to crush it. Most of the Hmong migrated again, this time toward the west to the mountains of Quechua and Sichuan. More insurrections followed. Some Hmong warriors were known for using poisoned arrows. Others went into battle dressed in copper and buffalo hide armor, carrying knives clenched between their teeth in addition to the usual spears and shields. Some Hmong crossbows were so big it took three men to draw them. In the 16th century, in order to keep the Hmong from venturing outside Quechua, the Ming Dynasty constructed the Hmong Wall, a smaller version of the Great Wall of China that was 100 miles long, 10 feet tall, and manned by armed guards. For a time, the Hmong were contained, but not controlled. Gabriel de Magellan, a Jesuit missionary who traveled through China in the 17th century, wrote that they pay no tribute to the emperor nor yield him any obedience. The Chinese stand in fear of them, so that after several trials which they have made their prowess, they have been forced to let them live at their own liberty. The Chinese tried to pacify and sinicize the Hmong by telling them that they had to surrender their arms and they had to wear Chinese clothes, that the men had to cut their hair short, and that they were forbidden to sacrifice buffaloes. Those who submitted were called the cooked Miao. Those who refused were the raw Miao. There were a lot more raw Miao than cooked ones. In 1730, or thereabouts, hundreds of Hmong warriors killed their wives and children, believing that they would fight more fiercely if they had nothing to lose. It worked for a while. Thus unencumbered, they seized several passes severing Chinese supply lines before they themselves were all killed or captured. It is perhaps no surprise that by the beginning of the 19th century, a large number of Hmong decided that they had had enough of China. Not only were they fed up with being persecuted, but their soil was also getting depleted. There was a rash of epidemics and taxes were rising. Although the majority of Hmong stayed behind, today there are about 5 million Hmong in China, more than in any other country. About a half million migrated to Indochina, walking the ridge lines, driving their horses and cattle ahead of them, carrying everything they owned. As was their custom, they went to the highlands, settling first in what are now Vietnam and Laos, and later Thailand. For the most part, they built their villages in places where no one else wanted to live. But if the local tribes objected or demanded tribute, the Hmong fought back with flintlock, blunderbusses, or with their fists, and usually won. Father Moten quotes an official who said, "I saw a Mio take my son by the feet and break his spine against the post of my hut." After the French established control over Indochina in the 1890s, the Hmong rebelled against their extortionate tax systems in a series of revolts. One of them, called the Mad Men's War, which lasted from 1919 to 1921, was led by a messianic figure named Pa Che, who had a habit of climbing trees so that he could receive his military orders directly from heaven. His followers blew away large numbers of colonial soldiers with 10-foot-long cannons made from tree trunks. Only after the French granted them special administrative status in 1920, acknowledging that the best way to avoid being driven crazy by them was to leave them alone, did the Hmong of Laos, who constituted the largest group outside China, settle down peaceably to several unbroken decades of farming mountain rice, growing opium, and having as little contact as possible with the French, the Lowland Lao, or any of the other ethnic groups who lived at lower elevations. The history of the Hmong yields several lessons that anyone who deals with them might do well to remember. Among the most obvious of these are that the Hmong do not like to take orders, that they do not like to lose, that they would rather flee, fight, or die than surrender, that they are not intimidated by being outnumbered, that they are rarely persuaded that the customs of other cultures, even those more powerful than their own, are superior, and that they are capable of getting very angry. Whether you find these traits infuriating or admirable depends largely on whether or not you are trying to make a Hmong do something he or she would prefer not to do. Those who have tried to defeat, deceive, govern, regulate, constrain, assimilate, intimidate, or patronize the Hmong have, as a rule, disliked them intensely. On the other hand, many historians, anthropologists, and missionaries, to whom the Hmong have usually been polite, if not always receptive, as long as the proselytizing has not been coercive, have developed a great fondness for them. Father Savino wrote that the Hmong possessed a bravery and courage inferior to that of no other people, because of which they have never had a homeland, but neither have they known servitude and slavery. William Robert Geddes, an Australian anthropologist, spent most of 1958 and 1959 in Pasaliam, a Hmong village in northern Thailand. Though more Hmong lived in Laos and Vietnam, most Western observers in the last half century or so have worked in Thailand because of its stabler political situation. Geddes did not find his fieldwork easy. The villagers were too proud to sell him food, so he had to transport his supplies by pack horse, nor would they allow themselves to be hired to build him a house, so he had to employ opium addicts from a Thai village lower down the mountain. However, the Hmong eventually won his deep respect. In his book, Migrants of the Mountains, Geddes wrote, "The preservation by the Miao of their ethnic identity, for which a long time, despite their being split into many small groups, surrounded by different alien peoples and scattered over a vast geographic area, is an outstanding record paralleling in some ways that of the Jews, but more remarkable because they lacked the unifying forces of literacy and a doctrinal religion, and because the features they preserved seemed to be more numerous." Robert Cooper, a British anthropologist who spent 2 years studying resource scarcity in 4 Hmong communities in northern Thailand, described his research subjects as polite, without fawning, proud but not arrogant, hospitable without being pushy, discreet respecters of personal liberty who demand only that their liberty be respected in return. people who do not steal or lie. Self-sufficient people who showed no trace of jealousy of an outsider who said he wanted to live like a monk, yet owned an expensive motorcycle, a tape recorder, cameras, and who never had to work for a living. From his post in the Hmong village of Khe Kno, also in northern Thailand, Father Moton wrote in his History of the Hmong, a wonderful book exuberantly translated from the French by an Irish nun who had once been the tutor of the future king of Thailand, and printed, rather faintly, in Bangkok. Though they are but a small people, the Hmong still prove to be great men. What particularly strikes me is to see how this small race has always managed to survive, though they often had to face more powerful nations. Let us consider, for example, that the Chinese were 250 times more numerous than they, and yet never found their way to swallow them. The Hmong have never possessed a country of their own. They have never got a king worthy of this name, and yet they have passed through the ages remaining what they have always wished to be. That is to say, free men with the right to live in this world as Hmong. Who could not admire them for that? One of the recurring characters in Hmong folk tales is the orphan, a young man whose parents have died, leaving him alone to live by his wits. In one story collected by Charles Johnson, the orphan offers the hospitality of his humble home to two sisters, one good and one snotty. The snotty one says, "What? With a filthy orphan boy like you? Ha! You're so ragged, you're almost naked. Your penis is dirty with ashes. You must eat on the ground and sleep in the mud like a buffalo. I don't think you even have any drink or tobacco to offer us." The orphan may not have a clean penis, but he is clever, energetic, brave, persistent, and a virtuoso player of the qing, a musical instrument highly esteemed by the Hmong, that is made from six curving bamboo pipes attached to a wooden wind chamber. Though he lives by himself on the margins of society, reviled by almost everyone, he knows in his heart that he is actually superior to all his detractors. Charles Johnson points out that the orphan is, of course, a symbol of the Hmong people. In this story, the orphan marries the good sister who is able to perceive his true value, and they prosper and have children. The snotty sister ends up married to the kind of da who lives in a cave, drinks blood, and makes women sterile. Chapter 3. The Spirit Catches You and You Fall Down. When Leah was about 3 months old, her sister Yur slammed the front door of the Lisa's apartment. A few moments later, Leah's eyes rolled up, her arms jerked over her head, and she fainted. The Lees had little doubt what had happened. Despite the careful installation of Leah's soul during the Hupli ceremony, the noise of the door had been so profoundly frightening that her soul had fled her body and become lost. They recognized the resulting symptoms as Kaudape, which means the spirit catches you and you fall down. The spirit referred to in this phrase is a soul-stealing da. Be means to catch or hit. And kao means to fall over with one's root still in the ground, as grain might be beaten down by the wind or rain. In Hmong English dictionaries, kaudape is generally translated as epilepsy. It is an illness well known to the Hmong who regard it with ambivalence. On the one hand, it is acknowledged to be a serious and potentially dangerous condition. Tony Coelho, who was Merced's congressman from 1979 to 1989, is an epileptic. Coelho is a popular figure among the Hmong, and a few years ago, some local Hmong men were sufficiently concerned when they learned he suffered from kaudape that they volunteered the services of a shaman, a tsineng, to perform a ceremony that would retrieve Coelho's errant soul. The leader to whom they made this proposition politely discouraged them, suspecting that Coelho, who is a Catholic of Portuguese descent, might not appreciate having chickens and maybe pigs as well sacrificed on his behalf. On the other hand, the Hmong considered kaudape to be an illness of some distinction. This fact might have surprised Tony Coelho no less than the dead chickens would have. Before he entered politics, Coelho planned to become a Jesuit priest, but was barred by a canon forbidding the ordination of epileptics. What was considered a disqualifying impairment by Coelho's church might have been seen by the Hmong as a sign that he was particularly fit for divine office. Hmong epileptics often become shamans. Their seizures are thought to be evidence that they have the power to perceive things other people cannot see, as well as facilitating their entry into trances, a prerequisite for their journeys into the realm of the unseen. The fact that they have been ill themselves gives them an intuitive sympathy for the suffering of others and lends them emotional credibility as healers. Becoming a Tsining is not a choice. It is a vocation. The calling is revealed when a person falls sick, either with Kaudape or with some other illness whose symptoms similarly include shivering and pain. An established Tsining summoned to diagnose the problem may conclude from these symptoms that the person, who is usually not always male, has been chosen to be the host of a healing spirit, a Ning. Tsining means person with a healing spirit. It is an offer that the sick person cannot refuse, since if he rejects this vocation, he will die. In any case, few Hmong would choose to decline. Although shamanism is an arduous calling that requires years of training with the master in order to learn the ritual techniques and chants, it confers an enormous amount of social status in the community and publicly marks the Tsining as a person of high moral character, since a healing spirit would never choose a no-account host. Even if an epileptic turns out not to be elected to host a Ning, his illness with its thrilling aura of the supermundane singles him out as a person of consequence. In their attitude towards Lia's seizures, the Lies reflected this mixture of concern and pride. The Hmong are known for the gentleness with which they treat their children. Hugo Adolf Bernitzik, a German ethnographer who lived with the Hmong of Thailand for several years during the 1930s, wrote that the Hmong he had studied regarded a child as the most treasured possession a person can have. In Laos, a baby was never apart from its mother, sleeping in her arms all night and riding on her back all day. Small children were rarely abused. It was believed that a da who witnessed mistreatment might take the child, assuming it was not wanted. The Hmong who lived in the United States have continued to be unusually attentive parents. A study conducted at the University of Minnesota found Hmong infants in the first month of life to be less irritable and more securely attached to their mothers than Caucasian infants, a difference the researcher attributed to the fact that the Hmong mothers were, without exception, more sensitive, more accepting, and more responsive, as well as exquisitely attuned to their children's signals. Another study, conducted in Portland, Oregon, found that Hmong mothers held and touched their babies far more frequently than Caucasian mothers. In a third study, conducted at the Hennepin County Medical Center in Minnesota, a group of Hmong mothers of toddlers surpassed a group of Caucasian mothers of similar socioeconomic status in every one of 14 categories selected from the Eglin Mother-Child Rating Scale, ranging from speed of responsiveness to fussing and crying to delight. Phua and Akau had nurtured Lia in typical Hmong fashion. On the Eglin scale, they would have scored especially high in delight, and they were naturally distressed to think that anything might compromise her health and happiness. They, therefore, hoped that at least most of the time that the Kaudape could be healed. Yet they also considered the illness an honor. Janine Hilt, a social worker who knew the Lies well, told me, they felt Lia was kind of an anointed one, like a member of royalty. She was a very special person in their culture because she had these spirits in her, and she might grow up to be a shaman. And so sometimes their thinking was that this was not so much a medical problem as it was a blessing. Of the 40 or so American doctors, nurses, and Merced County Agency employees I spoke with who had dealt with Lia and her family, several had a vague idea that spirits were somehow involved. But Janine Hilt was the only one who had actually asked the Lees what they thought was the cause of their daughter's illness. Within the Lee family, in one of those unconscious processes of selection that are as mysterious as any other form of falling in love, it was obvious that Leah was her parents' favorite, the child they considered the most beautiful, the one who was most extravagantly hugged and kissed, the one who was dressed in the most exquisite garments, embroidered by Fu wearing dime store glasses to work her almost microscopic stitches. Whether Leah occupied this position from the moment of her birth, whether it was a result of her spiritually distinguished illness, or whether it came from the special tenderness any parent feels for a sick child, is not a matter Fu and Nakao wish or are able to analyze. One thing that is clear is that for many years, the cost of that extra love was partially borne by her sister Yur. They blamed Yur for slamming the door, said Janine Hild. I tried many times to explain that the door had nothing to do with it, but they didn't believe me. Leah's illness made them so sad that I think for a long time, they treated Yur differently from their other children. During the next few months of her life, Leah had had at least 20 more seizures. On two occasions, Fu and Nakao were worried enough to carry her in their arms to the emergency room at Merced Community Medical Center, which was 3 blocks from their apartment. Like most Hmong refugees, they had their doubts about the efficacy of Western medical techniques. However, when they were living in the Majorim refugee camp in Thailand, their only surviving son, Chang, and 3 of their 6 surviving daughters, Ji, Mei, and Tru, had been seriously ill. Ji died. They took Chang, Mei, and Tru to the camp hospital. Chang and Mei recovered rapidly, and Tru was sent to another, larger hospital, where she eventually recovered as well. The Lees also concurrently addressed the possible spiritual origins of their children's illnesses by moving to a new hut. A dead person had been buried beneath their old one, and his soul might have wished to harm the new residents. This experience did nothing to shake their faith in traditional Hmong beliefs about the causes and cures of illness, but it did convince them that on some occasions, Western doctors could be of additional help, and it would do no harm to hedge their bets. County hospitals have a reputation for being crowded, dilapidated, and dingy. Merced's County Hospital, with which the Lees would become all too familiar over the next few years, is none of these. The MCMC complex includes a modern 42,000-square-foot wing. It looks sort of like an Art Modern ocean liner that houses coronary care, intensive care, and transitional care units, 154 medical and surgical beds, medical and radiology laboratories outfitted with state-of-the-art diagnostic equipment, and a blood bank. The waiting rooms in the hospital and its attached clinic have unshredded magazines, unsmelly bathrooms, and floors that have been scrubbed to an aseptic gloss. MCMC is a teaching hospital, staffed in part by the faculty and residents of the Family Practice Residency, which is affiliated with the University of California at Davis. The residency program is nationally known and receives at least 150 applications annually for its 6 first-year positions. Like many other rural county hospitals, which were likely to feel the healthcare crunch before it reached urban hospitals, MCMC has been plagued with financial problems throughout the last 20 years. It accepts all patients, whether or not they can pay. Only 20% are privately insured, with most of the rest receiving aid from California's Medi-Cal, Medicare, or medically indigent adult programs, and a small, but to the hospital costly, percentage of neither insured nor covered by any federal or state program. The hospital receives reimbursements from public programs, but many of those reimbursements have been lowered or restricted in recent years. Although the private patients are far more profitable, MCMC's effort to attract what its administrator has called an improved payer mix have not been very successful. Merced's wealthier residents often choose either a private Catholic hospital 3 miles north of MCMC or a larger hospital in a nearby city such as Fresno. MCMC went through a particularly rough period during the late 80s, hitting bottom in 1988 when it had a $3.1 million deficit. During this same period, MCMC also experienced an expensive change in its patient population. Starting in the late 70s, Southeast Asian refugees began to move to Merced in large numbers.